Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, I've got a guest, Marcus O'Rourke from K-Wave is here. Plus, we're going to be talking about engineers all getting together, converging to look at the solar eclipse. And Marcus is going to fill us out on how you distribute audio to transmitters that are maybe 200 miles away. Plus, Chris Tobin is here, all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech.
TWRT is brought to you by the TELUS Alliance and the new OmniVolt audio processor. More processing power in one rack unit than others give you in three. By BSW, Broadcast Supply Worldwide, where the remote sale is on. Save on headsets and remote packages at BSWUSA.com. And by Lavvo, providing seamless integration of your work processes and the uncomplicated operation of complex technology. See Lavvo in your future at Lavvo.com/twerked.
Hey, everybody, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And on this show, we're going to be talking about this guy, Marcus O'Rourke. He's going to join us from K-Wave. Hey, Marcus, how are you?
Good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you. I know we're sitting kind of buddy-buddy here, but when you only got one camera, that's what you do. We're going to be talking about this topic of increasing your radio station's reach and coverage by using some of the legal means like translators and HD signals and lots of interesting things. And then how, you know, we're going to talk to Marcus about how they are modifying their programming for different markets so that it still sounds localized and they're getting out to reach more people, all from a network operations center in Santa Ana, California. That's where we are, right?
Santa yes. Ana?
Okay, good, good. All right. So our show here, Chris Tobin is with us from New York. Chris, welcome in. Glad you're here.
Well, thank you, Kirk. I'm looking forward to it. Uh-oh. Oh, there we go. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm here having a good time. Here we go. You see me? There we go. Look at that.
I do.
Very nice. Sounds like you guys are having a good time out there.
Yeah, well, I got I'll fill you in on a minute. Why don't you give us a quick report from your place? First of all, where are you today?
I'm at the studio, the radio station studios. This is the talk studio. It's a U87 microphone, Neumann.
Oh, wow.
So I'm using that.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. I feel like Garrison Keillor, you know. I'm at a I start reading something. Brazilian Week Newark celebrates the independence of Brazil. You know, you get behind a microphone like this, you just sort of have to get into that mode, you know.
Yeah.
Gary Owens. There we go. We'd be Gary Owens. Huh?
We're using a condenser mic here, but it's not doesn't quite have the reputation of yours. This is what, an Audio-Technica?
Audio-Technica 4050.
4050. So it's a respectable mic.
That's nice. That's very nice.
We're not able to close talk it because then we'd be really, it'd be weird. So, you're close talking your mic, you know? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Welcome to the force.
Chris, we'll tell you what, we're going to jump right into several topics, including our producer, Suncast, is going to join us for a really cool little update on what we got to do together last week. Suncast, if you don't mind, let's do the ad first, and then we'll bring you in. Does that work with your workflow, Suncast? Yes,
certainly.
Okay, good. I didn't know if, maybe if you and the commercial were on the same machine or something. Oh well, our ad is coming off the folks at Lavvo. So hey, let me tell you, our show is brought to you in part This Week in Radio Tech, brought to you in part by our friends at Lavvo. Now, it's pronounced Lavvo, but it's spelled L-A-W-O because it's a German company. Philip Lavvo is the CEO of Lavvo, and the website is lavvo.com, but you want to put /twert on there because that will take you right to the page that you're interested in and that we're talking about. You know, Lavvo makes broadcast consoles big consoles for big venues like the Olympics and installed sound systems in huge theaters and opera centers and things like that. But they're also used in radio broadcasts, not just television, multi-track sound. They can do all that. But they also do radio consoles. Stations or networks like the BBC and the Canadian Broadcasting Company and NPR, these broadcasters have all chosen Lavvo to be their console that they do all their programming and content creation with. Well, Lavvo has a whole line of radio broadcast products. And what ought to interest you about these is that they have a reputation for making workflows easy, making complicated workflows a whole lot easier. I'm trying to scroll something that's not there. How about we do that? There we go. getting old. Not sure what I'm clicking on. Am I clicking on the Lavo ad? Well, go to lavo.com/twert. It'll take you right to the radio consoles. They have a line of consoles that are called the Crystal line. And then the Crystal Clear. We've talked about both of these on the show. And the Crystal Clear is really interesting because it's what you might call a virtual radio console. Yeah, there's hardware. It sits back in your rack room or in the studio, and that's where all your audio inputs and outputs go. But the control surface for it is actually a multi-touch touchscreen monitor. And that's pretty cool. Why? Well, because first of all, you can pick it up and take it somewhere. Just plug it back into the network, boot it up, and you're back controlling your station again. And by the way, your station doesn't go off the air when you are moving or have your console turned off because the mix engine is still doing what it was supposed to do. But the virtual console is the Crystal Clear console. It's featured on the website, so find out about that. Of course, Lavo has routing systems, and these routing systems can use Ravenna for audio over IP. It's AES-67 compatible, so if you have other AES-67 devices like a Neumann mic with the AES-67 module, or if you have some Genelec speakers that are AES-67, or, hey, from the world of video, we're going to see a lot of products come out in the next few years that the audio works either over SDI or over AES-67. And as we move to a more AOIP-centric or IP-centric workflow in television, you're going to see that SDI plug go away eventually, and you'll be all over the network, and your audio will be AES-67. So Lavo is absolutely ready for that, to help you with that. Then there's virtual radio in their Relay product. This is new, and it's out there a little bit, and they are, you know, they're looking for people to try this out. It's all of your radio station functions in one box that you can carry with you. And hey, if you need to carry your radio station with you, then there you go. Relay can do it. And finally, there's the new Ruby console, introduced just about a year ago at the IBC in Amsterdam. Ruby is a whole new way of thinking about radio workflow, where physical and on-screen multi-touch controls combine to give your talent a revolutionary new way to create. What does that mean? Well, it's all these features that we've been talking about that are available in a Lavo console, like auto mix and the auto preset of your levels. You can have a loud and boisterous talent come in or a guest come in, and you just want to reach over there and push them away from the microphone, but you don't have to. You touch a button on the Lavo console, and you get an automatic setting of the preamp level. This isn't downstream from the preamp. This actually takes care of the level at the preamp input. So you don't get any distortion or overmod. Or if you got somebody that's shy and doesn't talk loud, you can boost it right there at the preamp. Check out lavo.com/twert. And we appreciate Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and hope you will too. All right, we're back here. Marcus O'Rourke from K-Wave in Santa Ana, California is with us. And I want to bring in real quickly at the top of the show here, our friend Suncast, the producer of the show. Now, we had a great event happen 3 days ago on Monday, and I'm sure all of our geeky friends are aware it was a full solar eclipse over a huge swath, a path across the U.S. Suncast, you showed up in Nashville, and I got to spend the day with you. Why don't you tell us about your experience in this solar eclipse?
Well, I did. It was so much fun doing this because I had known this was happening for like about a year now. My sister lives in Nashville, so it was very easy for me just to head down there, drive down there. Drive kind of wasn't that great, but of course, that wasn't the main reason that I wanted to do this. It's the solar eclipse. So it was very easy for me to drive down there, stay with my sister, and then just hang out with you and watch the solar eclipse. It was just a very amazing thing to see. I've never seen one in person, so this was really my first time seeing a solar eclipse, especially a total solar eclipse, which hasn't been seen in like almost 99 years, they said, I think, which was really cool to see this rare phenomenon in the United States. Yeah. So I was very excited to see that. I had a whole lot of fun hanging out with you and everybody else there.
So, yeah, Cornelius Gould from the Telos Alliance was there. He's the senior algorithm developer now for Omnia. And Corny brought his son, Ben. And then also there was a friend. He's never been on the show, and I'd like to have him on. An engineer from New York City. Chris, you know him. Alex Roman was there. And, Chris, I was surprised Alex came down. Does he seem like an eclipse worshiper to you?
Oh, yeah. Alex, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
He goes for the good stuff. Yeah, absolutely. And funny because we were just together three days earlier from the week before with the combiner work he was doing. That was one of the stations.
Yeah, he flew in, I think, Sunday night, and stayed in a downtown hotel. How he got a hotel room, I have no idea. He could have stayed at our house, but yeah, we didn't know he was coming down until he posted on Facebook, "Hey, I'm going to Nashville to see the eclipse." Holy cow. So we got him there. Chris, what was – did you got a partial eclipse in New York, right?
Yeah, I was doing work at the transmitter. Went out on the rooftop at Times Square and got a partial, a little cloudy. You could see some hint of, you know, a dimming sunlight, if you will. So I went back inside and dialed up the NASA websites and looked for the raw video, and it was more fun watching that. So,
oh yeah, cool. I'm sure that it's kind of like going to a pro football game. You can see it better on TV than you can, you know.
Well, yeah, they had better angles. I will say that.
yeah. So, Suncast, we forgot to turn on a TV or a video feed, right? I didn't see you watch anything else.
No, I don't think we needed to do that. I mean, we had so much camera gear there, and it was just such a spectacular view that I don't think any of us really had any interest in watching a NASA feed or anything that was online. It was just such a great day to watch. There was some clouds, but we looked out, and we didn't have a single cloud during the total eclipse.
And actually, I found out something about that phenomenon. I'll go into it in just a minute. Let's kind of bring this back to radio. Chris, I saw there were some posts on Facebook and other places about how the eclipse and its passage across the U.S. and the changes in the atmospheric layers that reflect AM waves and that may cause tropospheric ducting for other higher frequencies. I read a little bit about this, but unfortunately, I didn't get into it. And I saw after it happened, engineer friends had posted their experiences with receiving radio stations as the eclipse cool area passed over the U.S. Chris, do you know anything about changes in RF propagation during the middle of the day when an eclipse happens?
Well, I read about it. There have been times with weather conditions when the air masses change temperature, and occasionally you get some crazy, tropospheric or ducting, as some people like to call it. But it was fun reading about it for the eclipse, and yeah, it's pretty cool. It's like taking a big, like a flashlight reflector, and just slowly turning an arc and watching the light get bounced off the reflector as you're pointing at it. It was pretty cool. I mean, when you think about it, the sun, the big noise generator, it does a lot to the atmosphere. It does a lot to the atmosphere and a lot to communications on many frequencies, not just one set as we would think AM or FM, but everywhere. So the whole spectrum can get impacted. It just depends on varying degrees, but it's pretty cool. It's something to read about, watch what people talk about. It's cool. It was really good.
What was amazing to me, I think all of us gathered at my sister's house. We were north of Nashville, about 30 miles in a town called White House, Tennessee. And White House, where my sister lives, is probably 3, 4, 5 miles from the absolute dead center line of the totality. Now, my house in Nashville was still in the totality, but only for a minute and 20 seconds. And at my sister's house, it was 2 minutes and 39 seconds in totality. So that gave us that extra minute and 20 seconds of time that we wouldn't have had at my house to take more pictures. And I was flying a drone, and so that was pretty interesting. Now, Suncast, you can comment on this. Sure, when the partial eclipse was happening, as the moon was moving over between contact point C1 and what they call C2, of course, it got dimmer outside, but not a lot. But the characteristic of the light changed. It was, somebody said, it was almost looking like looking through a polarizing filter. Just your eyes and the day. It wasn't quite twilight looking. It was harsher than that. But it was harsh and dim. So there were clear shadows, almost straight down shadows. But it was dim, and that was weird. As opposed to twilight or dusk, when the shadows are long. And it's dim and generally a redder sky since you're going through all that atmosphere. So it was bluish. Wouldn't you say that, Suncast?
It was kind of like a blue, purple, maybe. It was just a very odd coloring of the world and everything that was going on. It was very surreal looking. Like, I love sunsets and I love dusk, but it was just a very surreal moment And that coloring, I mean, yes, sometimes at night you get that weird coloring if it goes through a cloud and you get some red skies and stuff shining off buildings. But this was just completely different than anything I've ever experienced before.
So but it stayed reasonably. I mean, your eyes adjusted slowly over an hour or more period. But then when the totality happened, then the lights went out almost completely. I mean, there was still a little bit of residual light from the corona, but having a sliver of sunlight left, there was still light. But when it went away, man, and then, of course, all the streetlights came on and the crickets started chirping and the birds started singing, and it was just kind of weird. And so for 2 minutes and 39 seconds, we had that. I was flying a drone and as high as I legally could, and was watching. I was told that the shadow would move across the face of the earth at hundreds of miles an hour. And I haven't calculated how fast it would be. And I was hoping to see a definitive line of light and dark moving across the earth. And I was up high enough to, you know, see a couple miles out. And I was disappointed because my thinking on that was actually wrong. It was not a clear, defined line. And if you saw any of NASA NOAA's satellite pictures of it moving across, it was a fuzzy shadow. It wasn't a clearly defined shadow, even though I guess my expectation, all those maps that we saw of where the totality was, they were all very sharply and clearly and precision defined, even based upon mountain ranges on the moon as to where the, well, that was for the totality. That wasn't for the shadow. And so I was disappointed because I didn't see a clearly defined line. I saw this shadow moving, but it wasn't as dramatic as I had hoped for. Now, Marcus, here in Santa Ana, you're nowhere near the totality. What did you see here in California?
No, we had like 65-ish%, but we were watching NASA, of course.
Ah, good.
But we're outside our building here, and there's like 20 people out there. My boss is actually the facility manager, so he had his welding mask out there, and everybody else had their solar glasses, and we saw, you know, kind of a little bit.
Yeah.
I made a little shoebox, the projection.
Oh, yeah, sure. Like we did back in 1979.
Yeah.
Before you were born, probably. Yeah.
But, yeah, so I made one of those. And
cool. So the most you saw was what we saw probably halfway into the partial part of the eclipse. Okay. So this thing about the clouds and of course, this, I have a weather station at the house, and after the eclipse was over, I went and looked at the graph of the temperature. And yeah, it dropped. I forget exactly how much. I want to say about 9, 10, 11 degrees. And of course, it got to its – it didn't – you know, you might think it gets its lowest when the sun is covered up. But actually, it's at its lowest after the sun starts getting uncovered, because the temperature keeps falling as long as there's less sunlight coming in than there is, you know, heat radiation. So the timing wasn't it was delayed slightly from the actual optical event. That's it. The temperature event delay is behind the optical event. But that was interesting. Now the clouds. So the next morning, had a great experience. Got to have breakfast with Mike Patton. Now, he's a contract engineer in broadcasting. He's been on our show a couple of times before. And Mike has a son and a soon-to-be daughter-in-law. And the son is a master's level meteorologist. He's got a master's degree. And his daughter's also a meteorologist. I mean, his soon-to-be daughter-in-law also has a meteorology degree, but also a planetary sciences degree. So these were the right people to be talking to having breakfast at Waffle House. So we talked about that. I said, okay, so why did the clouds seem to dissipate wherever the eclipse was in totality or to a large extent? Now, we had a few puffy clouds, but we weren't really worried about not seeing it. It was may have been, I would guess, 30% coverage. We could have been unlucky. But as we went in totality, we looked up, we saw a few clouds on the horizon, but almost nothing in terms of clouds right over us. Well, what happens is the sun goes away. We think of summertime cumulus puffy clouds as being formed by packets of rising air, parcels we call them in meteorology. And when the sun goes away, or when it was getting cool from a partial eclipse, you didn't have this heating anymore. So there was no more rising air. There's nothing to keep the clouds buoyant. And so what clouds were there started to descend. And as they descended, they would start to dissipate into higher, I guess, higher pressure air. Anyway, they would dissipate, and after the sun left, I think some of the clouds came back. Now, the clouds didn't dissipate in areas where there was already a preponderance of cloudiness. For example, right over the city of Nashville, people were watching it downtown, and they were horribly disappointed because the sun covered up the totality for a lot of downtown Nashville. And the problem there was the heat island effect, where you have all these huge skyscraper buildings and lots of concrete and steel and marble, and it's all holding heat. And the sun goes away, and guess what? Heat keeps rising off of downtown Nashville. That's the heat island. And so the clouds were still being partially supported by that, and they didn't dissipate. So there you go. Have we talked about that enough?
It's interesting to me.
Yeah. Suncast, thanks for joining us. I sure appreciate that. All right. We ought to jump into technology, broadcast technology, as we promised that we would. So I'm out here for the podcast convention, and I'm out here talking to people who are going to replace radio, so they say. So, and then they might. Podcasts are getting a whole lot of traction. We heard from Edison Research last night at a keynote address. And I wouldn't say that radio is exactly in trouble yet. It still has majority audience in almost every measurable capacity. But, podcast listening is on the rise. People are interested, especially if you're a person who listens to a podcast anyway, then you're very likely not to listen to much radio. Now, if you don't listen to podcasts on any kind of regular basis, you're still going to be a radio listener. So we're okay for now. But I think radio stations have got to think a lot about, hey, we're in a perfect position to produce content, right? I mean, Chris's station there, the Jazz station, they produce a ton of content. I don't think all of it makes it to air, at least not on their main station right away. So, and broadcasters are starting to figure this out. So, Marcus, at your stations, you have Christian talk-based stations, right?
Right.
So you're playing some music, but not a lot.
Right. Mostly talk.
So a lot of your shows here on K-Wave, and we're going to talk about where else their station is putting out, but some of them just come into your station pre-produced.
Yep.
But you do some local production.
We do some local production. Some of the pastors will send us their raw stuff, and we'll chop it up and edit it, and then package it up for our use and then for them to use on other stations as well.
But you do produce some stuff locally. There's a couple of talk studios. In fact, we were going to be in a bigger talk studio, but there is a show that's going to be produced there in a few minutes, half an hour mm-hmm. or so. So we couldn't take up that studio. So you are producing. Now, when you produce a show locally, do you have a web presence for those shows?
There's not a website for it, mm-hmm. but we do promote it through our Facebook, through our social media, off our own station's website as well. But yeah, I mean, we push video onto YouTube and Facebook Live. So yeah.
So you are in the social media. People can partake of a lot of your programming, not listening to an FM channel.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we podcast it as well.
Okay. So, and a lot of stations are doing this, and I gotta say, if you're at a radio station that's not putting things out there on social media in a way that people can get it easily, I think now that's a mistake. You've got to put your programming out there where highlights, and hey, use those highlights to promote your station if you want. But I think that there are people who may never listen to a linear broadcast ever again. They may appreciate the stuff you pop on their social media pages. Mm-hmm. They may even subscribe to some podcast that you do. Chris, talk to us for a minute about what you guys do that gets turned into podcasts at your Jazz station.
Well, we have several shows on music that we do. Matter of fact, this weekend I'll be part of a team of recording jazz artists at the Charlie Bird, Bird Fest in the city, New York City. So we got Friday, Saturday, and Sunday we'll be recording different jazz artists, and that'll be turned into elements that will go on both radio and on our website. We do interviews where strictly just on the website. We have people writing about the various artists and various genre within the jazz name, if you will. And a lot of that is strictly on the website. So, but the programming director, the vice president of programming, his goal is to sort of augment the primary radio signal, which everybody's accustomed to, with the podcast/web content, we'll call it digital content. And that's the trick. And you know, if you have something of that makes sense, then, you know, it doesn't have to be 6 hours. It doesn't have to be 3 hours. We do a lot of stuff that could be 5 minutes, other stuff that's 30 minutes, depending on what it is. Yeah. We'll do an interview in the performance studio, and one or two of the songs of the artist will be recorded as a separate video. And then that'll be part of the web element. It doesn't even make it to air. And then there's a part of the show that gets recorded that goes to air and goes to web. So it's like a combination of both. So yes, you're not doing appointment radio per se, but you're offering enough of a sample. So during morning drive, if the interview is during morning drive, we do it in the sense of it's not just one big chunk. It's several pieces throughout the morning drive. So everybody samples it. You don't have to worry about getting up at 7 a.m. Oh, quick, let me get to hear what's going on. No, you'll hear it throughout the entire drive, all the different elements. And that gets you interested and then more thought process involved. Then you say, okay, let me check out the website when I get to the office. So now what we've done is cross-pollinated our in-office listening, because they can't listen on the radio, but they can hear the stream. When they go to the stream, they go to the website. See how it all comes together. And that's what you do. If you just play music straight and do nothing else, you're right, Kirk. You might as well just close up shop.
So I'm going to ask this question to Mark a second, but Chris, I'm going to ask you first. As a broadcast engineer who's been taking care of radio-centric facilities for probably 3 decades now, right? Is there anything different that you do so that the podcasts work better, so that the broadcaster is getting out in these other areas as efficiently as he or she could, as efficiently, or maybe more efficiently, or maybe less, as someone who is only a podcaster that doesn't have a linear channel to transmit on all the time? Talk to me about being an engineer in this slightly changing environment.
Well, I will say that, yes, it's 30 years plus of doing radio and some TV in there as well. What I've been doing in the last several years with the podcast part, radio/podcast elements, is creating... We did video. We've attached video to all the podcast stuff we do. We also record it and set it up in such a way that it's very comfortable. So the recording, the sound, everything sounds natural. It doesn't sound like it's in a fixed studio room. There's a little liveliness. It's a little different than what you'd expect from days of old. Basically, I mean, for the most part, things are still the same. You're telling a story. How well you tell it, how well you mic it is the same thing. But now there's an element of social media and video. So those are the elements that you have to really get more strength in and understanding how to do it. Because without it, you'll have nothing going for yourself.
I'm going to ask you in a few minutes, Chris, about some of the tools that, and you may not be highly involved in this part of it, maybe you are, but what are some of the publishing tools? And we'll get to that in a minute. I want to ask Marcus. It sounds like Chris is saying, and I would have to agree, that if you're an engineer that's built an effective broadcast facility, then you already have an effective podcast creation facility.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, we have amazing microphones that we get to use, mm-hmm. and professional level consoles and professional level recorders and editing. And, you know, it's just the ability to get it out now is where we just need to keep up and stay up with everything else.
So, I'll add to that. Thank you for that good answer. At the podcasting convention, I found pretty much what I expected to find in terms of the equipment that podcasters tend to use. So I met a lot of podcasters who use an inexpensive microphone, or maybe a good one, but probably inexpensive. They're using a Behringer console. And I say Behringer in a whole class of consoles. It could be a Samson, could be an Allen & Heath, could even be a Mackie, but it's probably a fairly inexpensive, like sub $200 console. And you can't hardly buy a fader for $200, you know, and a broadcast console. And so, and they're a lot of them are not doing audio processing, or they're doing their audio processing in Adobe Audition, which I got to say, it's less than ideal. I use Audition to process my audio books, but it's not what I'm used to in a more professional sense. So what I'm wondering is, you know, now there's the top tier of podcasters. There's the WNYCs of the world and other really professional organizations. They're already broadcasters, or they have former broadcasters working for them, and they have very professional setups. So it almost seems like there's not much in between people that already have a facility that's very professional and people that are doing this out of their home or basement, or they rent a small studio and doing it with essentially prosumer gear. I don't know if that's a problem or not. I used to hear a bunch of really horrible podcasts. Now, I probably don't sample as much anymore, but I'm not hearing as many. Maybe I'm only sampling the good podcasts. I don't know.
The equipment is an issue, but
yeah,
the equipment can be an issue, but there's no reason why you can't use a $60 mixer and microphone package to record something. I think what's important, and Andrew, who is the founder of the network, he and I talk about this all the time, and he gets a lot of calls from the various podcasters on his network who are not broadcast background. And they come up with some great solutions because of price, which makes total sense. And sometimes when I talk to them, they feel not embarrassed, but say like, well, you know, I can't afford to get a mixer that's this, this, and this, or the Neumann microphone like you're using. And I said, well, you don't need to. I said, what you need to focus on, just like they do in cinema, in the movies, is the content. So the conversation, it's two people in a room or at a bar or at a racetrack, wherever. And you talk and have a conversation. Just make sure you capture the sound properly. And you can use a $20 microphone and capture sound just fine if you mic properly. So I always try to say to folks, don't get fixated on the cost, the name, the room. If the application for your podcast is a conversation in a noisy environment, it's not noisy, but we'll say like a restaurant. If you're say for instance, one of the podcasts on this network that we're on is called The Skinny Pig, and the woman who does it is a food person. She does all kinds of food restaurants and stuff. And Dara is her name. And I was with her at one event recently, and I'm watching her take pictures and take notes of a restaurant food layout. With a brand new chef, a whole bit. And you know what we're using for lighting? Her iPhone just turning on the front of the iPhone, focusing it over the image and getting a close shot. That was it.
Yeah,
Now, when you look at the finished work on her website, on the blog post, you look at it like, oh, wow, that looks like a $4,000 camera shot. No, it was a good camera. Trust me, it was not a cheap camera. But the elements to make it work, because all she was focusing on is one, telling the story of what she enjoyed and showing the food. So I say, if you're doing a podcast, you're two people, three people, find out what it takes to do it right. If you're in a restaurant, say doing a review, close mic, keep the sound behind you. Think of it like in photography. You have bokeh, you have the blur behind the prime image, right? You take the shot, me here up front, everything behind me is blurred. Well, let's do that with audio. How about this? I'm close on the microphone. Everything in the background is low level chatter. So what? The focus is here. And I think that's what you need to work on. And at the podcast show you're at, I think you're going to come across a lot of folks who do that and do it well. And then there are those who don't, who need to learn it. One of the advantages we have as broadcasters is we've learned the mistakes over the years and have passed it down throughout the generations of broadcasters to keep the perfection level high. Podcasting has the same thing, but sometimes not the same outlet because it's not in the same discipline as broadcasters are. But
Chris,
the reason why you can't.
Really well said. I'm glad you said it that way because, hey, even on this podcast, we have been in situations where we had to use a really cheap mic. And right now, of course, we got this Audio-Technica mic here, but I've also got a $100 Rode mic. And yeah, you can use a cheaper mic. I do have a $150 mic pre back here, but it's considered a prosumer device, and I'm using a laptop. And the camera is a $89 camera. Granted, it wouldn't fly on some networks, and some TV engineers would go, "Ooh, look at the shading on that. What's wrong with that thing?" Okay, but it's apparently it is adequate for what we're doing now. So good, really good points. It's much more about how you use the gear than the price of the gear itself. Chris said talking into a $2,500 microphone. I should point out.
Yes. Okay. And by the way, and here let's get the camera on this one. And here is how I'm connecting to my laptop. Okay, so I am using a Neumann U87A. Yes, that's right, the NPR standard, into a USB converter on a Logitech camera. Because of my distance, this is ideal distance. If I was doing something larger, this camera would not work. So the application is perfect. Otherwise, I'm normally using my Sennheiser stick microphone. We're all familiar with it.
That is hilarious. Oh man, touche, man. Touché.
But it works. So, you know, it's about telling a story. I did an interview, it was a couple of weeks ago, with a friend of mine on a weekend in a restaurant. And he was like, how are we going to do this? It's too noisy. I said, no, we'll make it work. All I need you to do is stay close. I put a little piece of tape on the table. I said, you just make sure your chin is above this X and we'll be fine. And recording was ideal. It was, you could hear the two people talking. In the background, you could hear the chatter of the restaurant, but it was very low level. You know, let's say minus 20 on the VU meter. And it was just enough to make it work. And you stay focused. Their conversation was perfect. You were more focused on their talk and what they were saying than anything else. So I think as podcasters, if you're going into doing this stuff, focus on the storytelling and how best to convey it. Now, you could use the microphone I have here. Very nice choice. Or you can use a microphone like this, a stick mic for $40, and still get the job done. If you want the look, so be it. If you don't need the look, just worry about what you're talking about. And that's the key. Andrew and I have talked to many of his podcast folks and explained to them. I said, look, don't panic. You know, using that mixer is just fine. Understand that you have limitations and work within them. You'll be good. And as you get better at it, you'll know. You know, I have my little kid on the road I travel with. People look at it like, really? That's what you're using? It sounds pretty good. Yeah, who knew? Under $100.
Marcus, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, we kind of did a little unofficial mic shootout with some things that we had. We bought some of the little iPhone plug-in mic. One was a Sony, I can't remember. It just plugs right into the Lightning connector. Mm-hmm. We stuck them all together, did some. Everybody said the same thing. We had several different voices. And then we blind tested it with some of our staff.
Oh.
And said, okay, pick which one you think sounded the best. And surprisingly, those cheaper microphones scored really, really well. I mean, we're talking sub-$100 microphones. So
that, you know, I'm not surprised, especially after we had Sean Olive from Harman on our show, talking about headphone research and how there were plenty of headphones under $100 that were better than, you know, the $400 or $500 headphones.
And you know which microphone actually scored pretty well?
Yeah.
The iPhone mic built into the phone.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
Wow. Hey, all our listeners and viewers, you are watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 361. We're in Santa Ana, California at the studios of K-Wave, Christian station here in Southern California. Marcus O'Rourke is their engineer. And as we move along on the show, we're going to be talking about what we said we would, and that is about getting a signal out into various areas. But I came here for the podcast movement convention, and our friends at BSW, Broadcast Supply Worldwide, were there as well. And I've got a quick little video. Brian Seeley was there, and he'll tell us about what they're doing for podcasters.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Podcast Movement 2017. Brian Seeley here with Broadcast Supply Worldwide. We're here showing the latest and greatest for the podcast community, including microphones, consoles, interfaces, everything you can think of. Video for radio with our HDV mixer solution. We've got everything you need here, from the microphone to the internet airwaves. And I'd like to turn it over to John Lynch for a moment, who's going to talk about HDV Mixer, our video for podcast solution. John.
We have this program, which, as you can see, was utilizes with a radio station. This is for radio station remotes, but we've also developed it to a standpoint where now this could be for podcasters. Here on this program here, we talk about the HDV mixer. We call it HDV Lite. It's for podcasting to put your show onto Facebook Live. It's exclusive from BSW at 800-426-8434 or at BSWUSA.com.
And join us in September. We are rolling out our sports ball promotion. Wireless, headsets, codecs, anything you need to broadcast from the field. BSW will have a sale going on all those things. Comrex, Access, NX Codec will be shipping. We're also taking orders for the Opal. You're looking for a headset? Audio-Technica BPHS1 342. You buy two, you get the third for free. That's right. So come back and see us in September. BSWUSA.com. We'll take care of you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot to BSW USA, Broadcast Supply Worldwide, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And as you can see, they support podcasters with the gear that they need. And if you're a podcaster and you want to, you know, move into, you know, broadcast style equipment, well, of course they have that as well. And so many things that we use on our podcast actually have come from BSW. The one thing I want to mention that I always want to is that you can call order from BSW as late as 7 o'clock Eastern time. And if it's in their warehouse, which it probably is in Columbus, Ohio, they will put it on a UPS plane and you can have it the next morning if you're willing to pay for that. But it's available quickly. You know, none of this 2 weeks or so. They stock just a huge quantity of stuff, and they're right next to the Columbus Airport, which is a UPS hub. Thanks, BSW, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right. More to the subject of what we promised earlier in the podcast. So, K-Wave, tell us about your licensed facilities here, and then we're going to look at how K-Wave has expanded their coverage area and maybe how other broadcasters can do the same and what legal things you've done to make that possible.
Well, let's see. Started off in a small little 20,000-watt radio station in San Clemente. Hmm. Didn't really cover all – I mean, it covered a lot, but it was kind of in between San Diego, L.A. So we – about 2000 or so, moved to another mountaintop, got all kinds of more coverage, still covered our city of license. It was a very unique situation for us. But after that, the senior pastor kind of had this vision of expanding, buying other stations and expanding out into other areas.
Okay.
So the first one was in San Diego. It kind of covers Temecula and most of San Diego, and so we started up another studio here, brought in another set of staff, and we're basically running it from here.
Oh, so that new station wasn't just a simulcast?
Correct.
You had a second studio for it?
Correct, yeah, because okay. Our first station's commercial, and our second station was non-commercial.
Hard to split that. Okay,
yes.
Anyways, you kind of needed to do that, all right?
Yeah, we looked into trying to simulcast, but it was just like, I'd rather be safe and not have commercials accidentally go out. So then we had an opportunity to lease an HD2 in Las Vegas.
Ah, so this is a thing that's done.
Yes.
You can lease it out. If you own an FM with HDs on it.
Correct.
Now, I've heard this going on for niche programming, say maybe some, who knows, Polish language programming on an HD2 in Chicago.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And if you're not using it, just kind of sitting there idling.
Yeah.
And the station that we ended up licensing it or leasing it from, it was just sitting there idle.
Really?
So we approached them. They said, oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And we had a couple of translators inside their main station's coverage, and those turned into fill-in translators for that station that retransmits our HD2.
So, and as we were talking earlier, you used to feed those translators by a hop-hop method.
Yes.
That I'm sure wasn't the most reliable.
No, it was not. Feeding stuff down a desert chain with power that is less than reliable.
Now, your stations, except for the one, they're all commercial. They're in the commercial band, right?
No. One is in the commercial band.
Okay.
Our HD2 and translators are commercial.
Okay.
And that old desert one that we were feeding it with is non-commercialized. It's our San Diego one.
Okay. So my point there, if your translators were non-commercial, you can feed them with a satellite, I believe. You have more options.
Right.
But yours are commercial, so you can legally only feed them over the air from another FM or from the HD2.
Right.
But you don't have to own the HD2, do you?
Correct. Yeah, that's we just lease it.
Yeah. Okay, so how do you get your signal to the HD2 in Las Vegas?
So right now we feed it by satellite. So we also syndicate some of our programming to other Christian stations around the country. So we just kind of used some of that bandwidth and put our own channel up on that.
So you have a full-time channel, goes to satellite, it's picked up by your affiliate, by your station that you're leasing the HD2.
Right.
Is that a reliable link for you?
Very reliable.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, is that C or KU band?
KU band.
Okay. All right. So it goes on the other station's HD2 that you're leasing the HD2 from. Mm-hmm. Now that it's on the HD2, people could pick that up. Do you have any idea of what the listenership might be on the actual HD2?
Probably none.
Yeah?
I think the only people listening to the HD2 are us listening on the return.
Yeah.
So
this actually kind of is interesting. And sure, I wish HD radio was farther along than it is. Now, there are, you know, more and more cars come with it. I still don't have it in any of my vehicles. I did for a while when I had an adapter, but I don't have it anymore. But the it's interesting that the best use of the HD2 with the current legal ways to do it. See, I think it's a little silly. That's my opinion. Is you ought to be able to feed your translator. I mean, it's the listeners don't know how the translator they're listening to is being fed. It doesn't matter to them.
Right.
Why can't you feed it over the internet? Why can't you feed it? You could by satellite in the non-com band.
Right.
I don't know if you can in the commercial band. Because it has to do with the definition of a translator.
Right. Then it becomes a satellator. Yeah. And anyways.
Or an internet-a-later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A stream-a-later. So does away with the original meaning. So now you're on the HD2. If you don't want to tell me what brand, but what equipment do you use at the translator sites to reliably, without fail, pick up that HD2?
So we're using Innovonics, their little HD box that they have.
Oh, okay.
So okay. if it powers down, it comes right back and it's locked back to the HD2.
Good. Okay.
And from there, just we're processing it with an Omnia.
Oh,
Omnia One.
Okay.
But that's on the HD side.
So on when you pick it up off the air at the translator sites, it's been processed for bit rate reduction,
mm-hmm.
but not for FM transmission. So you process it again, I would assume, somewhat, at least to get it into a...
Right, a little bit. We have it does some of the clipping on the Nautel,
yeah.
what we're using for the transmitter.
Oh, okay, gotcha. All right, wow. So in this chain of events, when you were building this, what was the biggest question mark in your mind? Is this going to work? Because, and I'm asking you to address that because I know there are plenty of engineers out there who are either doing what you're doing or they're eventually going to.
Mm-hmm.
As stations, you know, hey, in Nashville where I live, there are several translators that iHeart has now. And this is becoming so more and more popular to get more alternative programming out there. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I don't know. Not for us as engineers to decide. It's up to us to make it work as the ownership would like it to work. So
right.
What'd you encounter?
Let's see. So kind of my biggest issue with reliability was power. I mean, we're at sites that have very little. We're at the end of a very long, long row of telephone poles that and the high desert has a lot of storms that come through.
Worse than that, you're at the end of a power feed that's single-ended.
Yes.
It has an earth return.
Yes.
It's nutty and, can't imagine that.
that specific site is a very interesting site.
Uh-huh.
It's fun in one respect, but
it's harsh and dangerous.
It is very harsh and very dangerous.
Yeah.
So power, but it really kind of comes down to where is your relationship going to be with that station at the end of that contract? Because at that point, if you decide to not renew,
mm-hmm.
well, now you've got a couple of translators. Now what do we do with them?
How do we feed them?
How do we feed them? Do we go back to the old arrangement? Do we try to find a new arrangement? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a great relationship with our parent station, if you will, on that end.
Yeah.
But again, it's just maintenance, getting up to the sites, getting up to the translator sites, because they also need the maintenance as well.
I never asked you where the translators are. You don't have to be specific, but are they hard to get to?
One is, I think I've scared a few people taking them up there.
Okay.
It's right off the 15. When you look up there, looks easy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's not easy at all.
Oh, man. The other one, just right outside of Henderson, and it's not hard. It's just the road has not been maintained in the 50 years or whatever since the site was built. So
transmitters, we ought to have to do a show on transmitter side access. For myself, one of my transmitter sites in Samoa is, if it's rained in the last 3 days, and it rains every day, if it's rained in the last 3 days, it's almost impossible to get there. and there's this one hill that is just horrible, and it's so slick that if you're on a four-wheeler, mm-hmm. and if your four-wheeler gets stuck, if you step off the four-wheeler, you will fall down into the mud. There's no other way around it. Yeah, you're getting nasty.
Yeah, our site in San Diego is on Indian land,
uh-huh.
and every time it rains, sorry, the road's closed. We need to go up there and fix it.
Really?
Oh, great. Oh. I mean, we even got to the point where, well, we need to get up there and service, so we bought one of those little Polaris tracked four-wheel drive vehicles to get up there.
With tracks. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because the snow can get pretty fun,
uh-huh.
too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, some of these sites are, I mean, I've gone up to him a lot now, so I'm used to it. But you know, I've taken videos, I've shown some people, and they look at me going,
"You drive this?"
So, what kind of vehicle are you driving to these sites?
F-250.
Oh wow, that's a heck of a truck. Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to talking about. So you had when you got the San Diego station, you added mm-hmm. a second studio.
Yep.
But now you gave me a tour, and I'm sorry, I lost count. We have four production studios mm-hmm. here. One of them used a lot for imaging, I guess. And then you've got a talk studio where you produce shows, and it has a control room.
Right.
And what else? And were there two other control rooms then?
So yeah, we have three control rooms.
Oh, okay.
Total of four, I guess, including the talk studio control room.
Wow.
Because that one of the shows that we do there gets syndicated, so we try to keep it as clean as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we have one for our LA station, one for our San Diego station, and one for the Las Vegas station.
Okay. So it sounds like a lot of the complaint about radio nowadays is it's all canned and produced in one place and shipped out, you know, like network TV. And it sounds like you are doing an amazing job of keeping it local, at least during certain day parts.
Right.
When you've got local talent. About the city where you're Las Vegas.
Well, in Las Vegas, we do have someone here who's talking.
Right.
And the talent is here. But we have a lot of connection to Las Vegas. We actually have staff there. And the program director is actually out there. So he sends us a lot of information. Hey, talk about this. Talk about this. No, you mispronounced this. And really does a pretty good job of keeping us in the loop, even though we're not out there.
I do believe, though, this would cost the company a lot more money to actually have studios and full staff in Las Vegas or in San Diego.
Right.
So it sounds like you've reached a pretty harmonious compromise between having people, talent there when it doesn't have to be there. It can be here, but you do have other sales and other people feeding that.
Right, right. I mean, we're really small, a really small staff. So a lot of our air staff gets shared among all three stations. And they're getting really good at being able to take what's being sent to them. And even our San Diego station, we send them out. You know, they get out to a lot of promotions events. A lot of promotions events.
Okay.
And
I see pictures on the walls here.
Yeah.
We
get them out there, and it helps them get connected to the communities that they're out as well.
Let's touch for a minute. And Chris Tobin used to be involved in the satellite networking business, so I want to hear Chris's take on this. But talk to me about your satellite uplink. How have you contracted for this? How does this work? If a station said, and by the way, not too many people are going to satellite when more and more reliable internet is available. But I think satellite costs have not risen a lot lately. In fact, I've talked to some people who do networking on satellite, and they said, we've gotten a really good deal. It's kind of hard for us to think about internet because we've gotten such a good deal on satellite.
Right.
Talk to me about that process of getting all that going.
Yeah. The capital costs are expensive. The building costs, yes, that's going to be expensive. But the actual operation in the 10 years that we've been doing it really has not risen much. Very little. But, I mean, we have an uplink here with a backup dish.
Oh, so you have a main uplink and a backup.
A main and a backup.
All right.
And we put, four channels all onto one carrier.
Okay.
So we can feed our stuff as well as the syndication stuff that we do.
Is your stuff on a bird that we would know in broadcasting, or is it?
AMC-1.
Okay. So that's not one that we typically look at as broadcasters.
Right.
Okay. Right. So it must have, you know, private distribution channels and deals. Okay.
Yeah. It's got FedEx and all kinds of other customers on it. But yeah, we buy a small piece of space segment on it.
Chris Tobin, can you talk to us about satellite distribution and how it's still effective today?
Oh, it's still effective. It's very efficient. The total cost of ownership is probably shifted still in a way that's doable for depending on the size of the business. I mean, it's a pure business decision. As Marcus pointed out, the upfront cost can be a little high, but once you do that, then you're in. You know, you have primary link, backup, distribution at any point you need. If your business model is such that you want to go from one to many, that's still probably the most efficient way. I mean, can you do it over internet connections? Sure. What costs are involved in trying to keep them up and running? You know, with a satellite downlink, you put that receiver and your studio on a generator and you're online and you're connected. If you're doing an internet connection through your local cable or DSL methods, you can put a UPS on that cable modem and it'll look really nice lit up. However, the other part of that may not have any battery source after a while. So those are the things you have to consider. Yes, it might be cheaper to do it through a cable modem slash DSL package, you know, for diverse paths. But the reality is, if you did satellite and you make sure your downlink is properly protected, you're up and running. And of course, the uplink you should be in place. But that's how I would look at it. Because when I worked for two large networks in distribution, we had many affiliates who were trying to get us to go, well, can we just take it over the internet? I'm like, well, yeah, you can. But here's a scenario that you might encounter. Oh, so which is it? The spot rate that you're going to lose because the show can't be heard, or the savings you made on that business decision and you still can't benefit because no money's coming in? These are things to consider. I mean, I'm being very frank about it, but it's true. And I'm sure Marcos has had these conversations with many a person saying, well, can't we just do it this way instead?
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Marcos, on your uplink dishes, what's, are they offset feed or center feed?
Offset.
And about how big are they?
These are, well, I'm trying to do the conversion to meters. I mean, they're like about 6 feet tall.
Oh, really? So, yeah. The KU band.
KU band.
Okay, okay. So the gear is, does it hang on the feed horn or back of the dish or what?
Yeah, it's all on the front. There's the SSPA is on there, LNB, all that comes back to our modem and encoder.
Now, when you set up an uplink, do you hire a company to come do that for you, or do you? What was your role in that?
So the company that we did kind of does everything.
Ah,
but. Okay. Part of it, we had to do some of the construction. So they said, well, you need to get this type of pipe. You need to put it in the ground at this depth. And they kind of gave us all the specs to get it started. Mm-hmm. And then they came in and actually built the dish, hung the dish, and did all the alignment and all that exciting, fun stuff.
Cool.
But back to what you were saying about the satellite distribution, one of our sites is completely off-grid. Our San Diego station is completely off-grid.
Really?
So for about 2 or 3 years, the only way to feed audio was by satellite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we finally got a microwave link up there. And
it's off grid because it's so remote.
So remote. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
This site was literally a hilltop in the middle of Indian land. And they said, you do all the work. You can put up a tower. And so we graded it, put the tower up. I mean, everything. But there's no way to get power or telephone or anything up there.
Wow. Well, that's curious then. What's the power level of that transmitter?
200 watts.
Okay. So is it a translator itself?
No, it's a full power.
It's a full power. Is it way over height?
It's very high, yeah.
Ah, okay. Okay, gotcha. So talk to me about your solar, right? Solar panels and battery system. Did you design this yourself, piece it together, or buy a package or what?
So we actually have a very good electrician that we contract with. He does a lot of our stuff here with the church as well. And he designed the solar system. We inherited it from the previous owner and had to the way that it was built was kind of underpowered for what we needed. And so we redesigned it with more efficient panels, more panels, aligned them in a way that they would catch the sun right. And that was probably a 3-year project of just building it, installing it, and getting everything just right.
What kind of remote telemetry do you have to that site with no power, telephone connection, and how do you get it back?
Well, we installed a microwave link
to
another mountaintop, and we have a T1 going to that.
Ah.
So okay. We're able to get some data back and forth.
Yeah.
But
is that how it's fed audio? Or no, it's a satellite receiver dish there.
Yes. So we now have internet too. Okay. We do feed it by internet as well. Well, it's MPLS basically.
Yeah.
But yeah. Before we had that, it was a cell connection that we sometimes had connection.
Yeah.
Sometimes we didn't.
Yeah.
But
wow.
That was a fun site. Is a fun site. It's kind of calmed down, but.
Okay, so you're not having to make regular trips there to put it back on the air.
No.
Okay.
No, we did install generators because when it gets cloudy, the
I was going to ask you how long the batteries last.
The batteries will last maybe a day and a half, two days. And then we do have a generator that kicks on. It just kind of supplement charges, and then we also put in a second generator if the whole solar system fails, which it has, just completely just goes away. that other generator will kick in and power everything.
By the way, the solar system, does it use an off-the-shelf inverter that you could just replace? It
uses Outback. Outback's inverters and controllers.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Cool. Hey, we are running close to the end of our show here. We're talking to Marcus O'Rourke from K-Wave in Santa Ana, California, with transmitters in other places as well, including as far away as Las Vegas. How far is Las Vegas from here?
200 and something miles.
Yeah, yeah.
300 miles.
I don't know how you ever did this with having a hop point. Oh, jeez. Doing it by satellites, much smarter. And Chris Tobin, of course, is with us as well. We got to hear from our sponsor, and then we've got a tip of the week from Chris Tobin, because he's good about that. He always does. And maybe between me and Marcus, we can figure out a tip of the week for you as well coming up. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends at Omnia and the brand new, incredible Omnia Volt audio processor. Let's take a look.
More top radio stations choose Omnia than all other competing processors combined. Now meet the Omnia Volt, sharing lineage with Omnia processors like the Omnia 11, electrifying, competitive, market-leading audio in a compact one-rack unit package. With Omnia Heritage built in, the Omnia Volt includes Dynamics Magic from Omnia chief algorithm designer Cornelius Gould, including six AGC sections from start to finish, deep bass, warmth, and stereo enhancers, 5-band time-align limiter, the world's best presets to get you started right, and spectrally pristine final processing designed by Frank Foti. OmniaVolt users love its Quick Tweak feature. Quick Tweak distills years of processing knowledge and proven approaches into simple controls that turn you into a processing pro. Nail your signature sound in minutes using advanced presets or your own settings right from the Volt's front panel or a PC. OmniaVolt brings charisma to your station's audio. FM translators and low-power FM stand out among the crowd. AM stations maximize clarity and coverage. Digital broadcasts sound clear and musical without fatiguing artifacts. Smart design, clearly visible outside and inside. Input and output connections in analog, AES-3, Livewire, and multiplex for FM. Automatic input selection handles redundant STLs. Remote control works with today's browsers, tablets, and smartphones. Idealized patch point for external watermarking. And hardened construction to withstand lightning strikes, surges, high RF fields, and harsh conditions.
The new Omnia Volt is stunning. Everyone will know you've got an Omnia on your station.
Omnia Volt is versatile, too. DSP Core firmware alters the personality of Volt to fit your changing needs. FM, AM, digital transmission, or studio processing. Volt can even be used as a standalone stereo generator. DSP cores aren't extra cost add-ons. Download the functionality you need for free. The Omnia Volt. Omnia audio processing for any station. And a smart upgrade for aspiring broadcasters. Proven audio processing that'll leave your competitors in the dust.
Thanks a lot to the TELUS Alliance and Omnia for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech and the Omnia Volt. And I got to tell you, a whole lot of the algorithms in the Omnia Volt came from Cornelius Gould, as the ad said. And man, he knows how to make music and voice just sounds so good. Check it out if you would. The Omnia Volt. All right, it's time for our tips of the week, and Chris Tobin probably has one. I'm going to ask him to wait for a second, because his is always way better than anything I ever come up with. So, no pressure, Chris. But I've got a tip of the week this week, and Marcus agrees. He thinks, yeah, well, that can work. So so much equipment nowadays has an Ethernet connection and a web GUI. And maybe other ways to get into it as well that you may not really think about. And this happened to me recently. I had a piece of equipment, and the web GUI still worked, but it had some processes in this piece of gear, because it's a software-based piece of gear, that died. And so I had to get that thing rebooted. And it's actually a little inconvenient for me to get to the web GUI. I've got to go TeamView VNC into another computer, then open a browser, and bring up the web GUI of the device of interest, because it's not available to me on the internet remotely, and I don't want it available. And then I've got to go to the system and tell it to reboot. And that's a lot to go through. Well, I found out that there's another way to reboot it, and that is using Telnet. a lot of gear has Telnet. Now, if you don't need Telnet, maybe it shouldn't be turned on because it is another way to, for bad guys to get into stuff. But this is only available. It's not, again, it's not internet facing at all. It's only on the local network. So I went to a computer, and instead of a browser, I open a DOS command box and I type in the IP address, Telnet space, and the IP address of what I want to go to. It's on a standard Telnet port. Log in. It might, in this case, it was the same username and password as the GUI would present. And then it's a Linux device. So you type what? Reboot. Reboot. And it reboots and bam, problem fixed. So good piece of that. There's more than one way to get into a lot of piece of equipment, unless you or the manufacturer specifically turned off Telnet or you were talking about SNMP. Maybe.
SNMP, yeah. I mean, our transmitters all use SNMP.
Ah.
And I don't know. I'm still a little nervous about it at some of these sites. So, I mean, I still, you know, put in the hard remote control lines in and just in case.
As a backup. Sure,
as a backup.
Sure, yeah.
But, yeah.
Cool. Well, Chris Tobin, that's our tip of the week. Other ways into a device other than the web GUI. And I'm such a visual guy. I'm only really good at the web GUI. What you got for us, Chris?
Well, I've done the Telnet a lot. I actually have some equipment. That's my failover or my backup to get in. The tip this week is, I know I've mentioned this a while back, but we should always revisit it. Transmitter sites where you keep a logbook. Did some work recently, went through my logs and noticing, oh, that's the problem we had 6 months ago. Now I remember we did to fix it. So keep a logbook handy. You could do it in your TOC as well in the studios, but at least the transmitter site. And remember, these are things that you don't go to every day. So you may make a note, you visit the site, why? Oh, phone company was here. Visit the site, why? AC was being serviced, or you just did regular transmitter maintenance, power supply replacement, who knows what, a tower inspection. Very handy to do. I know it's very, for some arcane thinking, like, what? I can do that on my phone. Just remember, if the phone battery goes out or you lose it or it's something goes wrong with the SIM card, that information is lost. So keep a logbook. It's very handy. And also, for those of you doing broadcasts, like recordings in the field and things of that sort that I'll be doing this weekend, when you have multiple road cases of equipment, it wouldn't hurt to P-touch label, or I should say label, the different interconnect cables. In the case of what I'm doing this weekend, I'll be doing a lot of fiber interconnects between consoles and ADAT machines. So I have all the fiber cables have numbers on them, and the ins and outs I've labeled with artist tape on the back of the console. And we just did the test today. I had somebody unplug everything. Going by the labeling alone, no notes, no phones, no nothing, I was able to reconnect all four road cases of gear and do 64 channels of audio recording with no problem. So labeling, logging, very important stuff to think about, and it will save your bacon sometime when you least expect it. Can't predict when, but it can happen. Same thing with a satellite downlink. You know what you should do? You should record the EBNO. The energy bit ratio that's on the receiver, so that when you call your satellite uplink facility, the NOC, and you say, hey, guys, I'm having a problem with my receiver, that operator may say to you, it might be Marcos, may say, what's the EBNO reading on the front of your receiver? it says two. Oh, okay. And how long has it been like that? If you have a logbook, you can go back and say it's been that way only for 3 days. Ah, well, maybe a tree fell. Maybe there's a tree in front of your dish. Maybe there's a bird's nest, bee's nest. That logging information is actually very helpful. And we talked about this for service call, customer support episode, remember? What should we tell the customer support person when we call them for help? How much information do we have on hand to give them a better picture? So if you're a satellite downlink, if you're an affiliate of a station such as we're talking about, it would be important to track that that satellite receiver's specs, the signal strength, RSSI, depending on which model you have.
Yeah. Good advice. And it, your advice about keeping a logbook is always the thing that I kind of don't want to hear. But you're so right. You're so right.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when you have other people maybe coming after you or taking care of it, or you're out of town. You're at the podcast movement and somebody else has to go on site and look at a problem. Well, the logbook.
I can tell you on many occasions, including the network operations I've been at, when I would be on vacation or traveling and somebody would say, okay, we're having a problem at the TOC, rack 32. It's the incoming show from so and so on the clients, the satellite services, and we're not sure what's going on. Something's wrong. What do we do? I would say, go to the logbook, look up that particular show's folder, and you'll find out all the information you need to fix the problem. What? Just go to the logbook. You'll be fine. And then I'll get an email later. yeah, we found the backup phone number and the ISDN we needed, and everything's back up and running, and the satellite queues are going out, automation's happening, and commercials are clearing. There you go.
As simple Chris as that. Reminds me constantly of the job's not finished until the paperwork is done.
Yep, but yep, exactly.
Now, one thing is, though,
yeah,
and it's a challenge for us lefties,
yeah,
to write neat enough that you can read it.
Well,
yes, that, I can attest to that.
Now, and I realize it doesn't help other people much, but if you do it electronically, you stand a risk of losing that. I've been keeping copious notes and important passwords or URIs and just stuff that I need to get at, license numbers for software in Google Docs. And I have an account for my radio, for my group of stations in Mississippi. I log into that. I go to Google Docs and bam, everything I need is all there. And my entire streaming computer can blow up and I can I can install my software, all my licenses, and point it at the right Icecast servers, do all of that in about 97 minutes and ask me how I know that. Because I had to. I got it all. There it is. Just copy, paste, type, and we were all the streams were back on in 97 minutes.
What happens if you can't access Google Docs?
Well, tell me from could Google go down and I couldn't access Google Docs?
Yeah, okay. You. This is a very good example. I could give you this is ideal. This past summer, as you know, I've been working on a large Wi-Fi project, and yeah. Apparently, at one of the locations where the Wi-Fi was being provided and the internet service was through that Wi-Fi, somehow, for some reason, someone decided to unplug the network connection at that site. Don't know right. why. We'll never know. However, what was interesting was the entire facility came to a dead halt because nobody could access their Google Docs accounts to get all the information they needed to take care of the dining hall, various other things. Everything that was needed to function at this facility came to a screeching halt. And I can tell you the calls for help to the folks working on the network was so loud and screaming. We're like, what the devil happened over there? And then after we got up and running, several hours later, we found out what happened. They couldn't access their Google Docs. So just keep in mind, if you keep anything on the cloud, we'll call it, find an alternate path to it, because you could be in a situation at 2 o'clock in the morning at your tower site, and you may not have connectivity that you think you should have.
Well, a paper backup, or as a lady famously said about 15 years ago, when you fix my computer, can you download the internet to it so I don't have to go online to see it?
Just make PDFs, put them on a thumb drive, and keep it at the site.
Right. Yep, you're right. You're right. Good advice.
Yeah, you take those Google Docs, you can PDF, put them on a thumb drive, and you keep them there, and you'll be fine.
Or print them.
I know,
them
it's binder, too simple.
Yeah, I know.
Or a binder, whatever, but yeah. And I know I'm going to get calls from certain people in the New York area going to say, you and your stupid thing, I don't need that. I got that at the site. We got plenty of backup. I know exactly who you are out there. I know who's going to call me.
Ignore Chris's advice at your own risk. Yeah. Hey, we got to go. This has been episode 361 with our guest, Marcus O'Rourke. He generously let me use his studio here at K-Wave in Santa Ana, California. People can, if they're in Santa Ana, they can listen to K-Wave at what frequency?
107.9.
The top of your dial. You can't go any farther to the right. And then San Diego?
San Diego is 88.9.
Okay, the non-com part. Mm-hmm. And in Las Vegas?
98.1.
There you go. Good dial positions all. From one end to the other, sure enough. And Chris, if people are in Jersey, Newark, and they want to hear some incredible jazz, a lot of it live, where would they go?
You just go to WBGO.org for those that like the stream stuff, or you can go to 88.7 and get the best sound right there on FM.
Good deal. Thanks, Chris. Thanks to Suncast for producing this show and for providing us a little cameo appearance on the show as well, talking about the solar eclipse. That was a great fun, and I hope we get to do something like that again sometime. We shouldn't stay apart for so long. And we got to go. Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to you, and we will see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.